the phi final of e to the I times the action. Okay? Now, this action is an integral dt of something. And in fact, if we have a field theory, it would be an integral d cubed dtx of some Lagrangian. Okay? So whatever this thing is very oscillatory. It's usually, it's often a very good idea to, instead of talking about this, talk about something that looks like that instead. Okay? Let me put a sub e here. So I'm going to move from time and replace time by a complex variable, I guess a minus sign there. Okay? Time is minus I, what I'll call a Euclidean time, t sub e. See, if I do that here, I turn the e to the minus iht into a minus e to the minus ht. Okay? But time is occurring everywhere analytically here. So what happens is that under this action, s goes into something that looks like I times what I'll call s Euclidean. So here, you know, here I might have something that looks like a time derivative squared minus some spatial derivative squared minus whatever, or whatever else I have. But if I put time goes to minus I time Euclidean, then s goes to I s Euclidean, where s Euclidean, the one I just comes from the t here. And s Euclidean is then an integral. Here I would just end up getting d by t Euclidean phi squared plus grad phi squared, and so on. So what this operation is doing is just converting evolution in Minkowski space to evolution in Euclidean space. I'm now treating time really on a perfectly symmetrical footing to the other dimensions. This is often called a Wick rotation or a Euclidean rotation. Okay, but the point is that that the Euclidean action, which is all you get, so all you do is everywhere there's a d by dt squared, you replace it by minus d by dt squared. In other words, everywhere there was a metric before, you replace the metric by the usual Euclidean metric. That's it. And the I's just all take care of themselves. But you go from having something which is oscillatory on both sides to having which is something nice and damped on both sides. Okay? So this is e to the minus ht. This is e to the minus the Euclidean action. And there's something particularly nice about this, which is that it gives you, I mean, normally we talk about the path integral as a way of getting, we talk about the path integral as a way of extracting transition amplitudes from one state to another state, but it's also a very effective way of deriving what the ground state wave function of a theory is. No matter how complicated and strongly interacting or anything it might be, what you do is you look at this object starting from any phi you want. So let's look in general at the object. E to the minus ht times any old phi in. And let me even just call it phi. Okay? Well, what is this? I would expand phi in a basis of energy eigenstates of h. So this would be e to the minus ent times n and phi. Okay? But now you see, as you send, so let's say I'm now looking at this from phi I to phi f again. Okay? Then there would be a phi f here. But now if I send capital T to infinity, you see that I get contribution from the ground state, which goes like e to the negative the ground state energy times t. That's already minuscule, okay? But all the excited states are even more minuscule compared to that. So as capital T goes to infinity, this goes like e to the minus e ground t times phi ground phi. So this is very cool, because you can now, by evaluating this path integral, but now making, doing the evaluation over the entire space, sending t to infinity, you find that if you do it, it should have a piece which is exponentially dying. The coefficient is the ground state energy. And how it depends on phi just tells you the ground state wave function. So this is a very pretty way of extracting the ground state wave function. It is a beautiful exercise to do this for the harmonic oscillator. Okay? You'll probably do it when whoever teaches you path integrals does it. But you get the half h bar omega and everything. Okay? So it's. But the slogan then is that the Euclidean path integral, which is just what we talked about, if I do the Euclidean path integral over all of space, it's a Euclidean space. So let's say we had a 1 plus 1 dimensional theory. That was the example that we just talked about. The Euclidean path integral would then be an integral over a 2-dimensional ordinary space, right? But if I do the integral over space but with a boundary at infinity, well, it's at infinity, but let me just translate it to draw it here. The boundary at infinity, and I specify that phi, when I do the path integral, is equal to some particular phi star on this boundary. Okay, the path integral over all phi, e to the minus the Euclidean action of phi, where at this boundary here, phi equals phi star, up to this factor that I'm not going to care about, which extracts the ground state energy, is equal to the ground state wave function as a function of phi, as a function of phi star. So if I want to know what the ground state wave function is for some configuration, I just stick that configuration in the boundary, and I do the path integral over everything, restricting myself to phis that agree with this phi star on the boundary. So if you know nothing about path integrals, all you have to do is believe this statement, and you can at least follow the rest of what I'll be saying. So now let us return to the problem of computing. I want to compute what is, so here I am, I'm not even talking about Rindler space, actually. I really just want to do the following. Well, you'll see why it's related to Rindler space in a second. But I just want to do literally what we said before. I want to split my one dimension up into here's the left, and here's the right, and the left. And I want to know what is the reduced density matrix on the right. That's a nice question, right? Now, that reduced density matrix will be the density matrix that the Rindler observer sees. That's simply because all the Rindler Hamiltonian is boosting this. Okay? So that reduced density matrix that is seen is just whatever the density matrix the Rindler observer sees. In particular, it's the density matrix the Rindler observer sees that its Rindler time tau equals zero. But remember, everything is tau independent. It's tau translationally invariant. And so the reduced density matrix at tau equals zero is the same reduced density matrix it sees at all other taus. So you could ask, why can't I just do it? You know, I just wrote down the wave function a second ago. I now just have to trace over this part of the system. And you could. You could, in principle, just write it down and just do it. But it's a horrible-looking integral. And it's not so easy to see. It's just a Gaussian integral, but it's a little bit horrible. And it's not totally trivial to see how to proceed. Okay? What that would do, by the way, is directly give you the reduced density matrix in the phi representation. Because I give you the Gaussian wave function in the phi representation. That may not be the most convenient form. In fact, thinking ahead a little bit, the reduced density matrix looks nice as a function directly of the Rindler Hamiltonian. And the Rindler Hamiltonian is not so trivially related to the anyway. So we want a slightly more indirect way of getting this answer, even though all it's doing is literally what we said. Just literally, we're just literally tracing out the left of the space. So let's see, what are we literally doing, right? What I want to do is I have the ground state wave function. The ground state wave function depends on the values in the phi representation. It depends on the values of the phi on the right and the values on the left. So I want the reduced density operator on the right, right, which happens to correspond to Rindler as well. That's nice. Okay, rho r. So this is literally, I want to integrate over all the configurations on the left. I want to integrate over all the different values of phi on the left. Psi ground star, phi right and phi left. Psi ground of phi right. Oh, sorry. So rho reduced, sandwiched between some state phi 1 on the right and another state phi 2 on the right, would then be psi ground star from over here. It would be psi ground star of phi right 2 and phi left. And on this side, it would be psi ground of phi right 1 and the same phi left, because I'm integrating over phi left. I'm taking the trace. Okay? So I'm taking the trace over phi left. So I have to learn how to do this integral. And this is an integral over all phis on the left, all the values of phi on the left, all the possible functional forms of phi on the left. This still looks like a pretty unfriendly integral. But now I'm going to interpret psi ground and psi ground here in the way I just told you a second ago. So let me draw a picture like this. I'm going to imagine that I computed this guy by doing now a Euclidean. This is now in a Euclidean space. This is in a 2D Euclidean space. I'm going to imagine that here we are, and this guy is computed by doing this Euclidean path integral over this entire region. Remember, we have to do the infinite Euclidean path integral, but with a boundary condition. And the boundary condition is that over here, on the surface here, I have to be given by what the value of phi is. And the value of phi here is phi right 1, and here it's phi left. Okay? Now, let me write the second one, psi ground star of phi 2 right and phi left. I can write that one in exactly the same way. Let me just choose to write it. It had to be one of the boundaries, right? Let me just choose to write it. In fact, it's exactly what would, anyway, this is really a convention. But let me choose to write it. I'll have to write it right above this, because they're really on the same place. But here, on this side, it'll have the value phi right 2. But notice on this side, it still has the same value phi left. Right? The values of phi left agree between here and there. Here I'm doing a trace, so the values of phi left agree on here and there. So in other words, the Euclidean path integral on the bottom here, This is giving me the bottom factor, psi ground of phi right 1 and phi left. And this Euclidean path integral on the top is giving me the factor psi ground 2. Psi ground star of phi right 2 and phi left. So you see, the density matrix is a funny-looking path integral. The density matrix is a path integral over everything. So now I get to do the path integral over the entire Euclidean space. I'm doing a path integral over the entire Euclidean space. Now, because I'm integrating over d phi left, that means that I can erase this line, right? I'm now integrating all over all of those two. So I'm doing the integral over d phi left. So that means I don't have to fix what the value of phi left is here and there. I'm integrating over that too. So now I'm just doing the entire Euclidean path integral. I'm doing the entire Euclidean path integral, but with a funny boundary condition that I draw a line from the origin out to infinity. On one side of the line, the value is phi right 1 of the field. And on the other side of the line, the value is phi right 2. Okay? But otherwise, all I'm doing is literally doing integral d phi e to the minus the Euclidean action for phi with these funny boundary conditions, right? With the boundary conditions, with these boundary conditions, phi right 1, phi right 2, otherwise integrating over everywhere else. Okay, but there's another way of interpreting doing this path integral. I can do this path integral by, let me start with phi right 1, and instead of just doing the whole thing like this, let me first do the piece of the path integral that takes me from this slice to this slice. I'll first do that part of the path integral. Then I'll do that part of it. Then I'll do that part of it. And I'll just swing around until I do the very last part of it on the other side. Okay. Now, what is the path integral between, what is this? This evolution is just a rotation in Euclidean space. Okay. So that path integral between this configuration and that configuration is just that of a path integral that would be the computation that we would have done if we were asking the question of what is e to the negative the Euclidean Hamiltonian, the Euclidean rotation, taking us from here to there. Okay? And then as we keep integrating, this whole thing is then nothing other than e to the negative 2 pi times the generator of Euclidean rotations. Okay? So this is nothing other than e to the negative 2 pi times, let me call it, the generator j of Euclidean rotations. That's between phi right 1 and phi right 2. But the generator of Euclidean rotations is nothing other than the Minkowski boost. It's the same operator. Okay. So this is phi right 2 e to the minus 2 pi h Rindler phi right 1. And that's how you know that the density matrix is thermal with temperature 2 pi. Okay. Okay. But this is a true fact about every horizon. Now we can actually ask just quickly an interesting question. So what is the entanglement entropy then? Let's say I just have a quantum field theory. What is the entanglement entropy Let's say I cut the space into two halves, just like what we talked about. So what is the entanglement entropy for the entanglement between the two sides? There's a very simple physical picture for it now, right? Because we just found out that the density matrix is thermal, and the temperature is going like if as I approach it, as I get within a distance epsilon here, if the distance is epsilon, then the temperature is going like 2 pi over epsilon. It's going like 1 over epsilon. So I have a sheet here, right? I'm dividing space into two bits, and the sheet, well, the area is infinite the way I've done it, right? So an infinite area sheet, this was a 1 plus 1 dimensional case. Sorry, I should have said that. This is a 1 plus 1 dimensional case, everything, all the arguments that I said go through exactly the same way in the higher dimensional case. So what happens, so there's a sheet separating the two regions of space, but the temperature as you approach the point of separation is getting hotter and hotter. So the entropy density would be going like temperature cubed. So it's going like the entropy density is going like 1 over epsilon cubed, but you're approaching it. There's a d epsilon over epsilon cubed, and the rest is translationally invariant in the other two directions. So it's just proportional to the area. Okay? It has to be proportional to the area. But then you see there is an interesting problem, right? Because it's going to be infinite. The entanglement entropy goes like the area of the area of the screen separating the two regions. Well, and it's blowing up. So if I stop at some thickness delta, it will be the area in units of delta. Okay. Now, why is there this infinite? It's because in field theory, again, we have these arbitrarily large fluctuations at arbitrarily short distances. And I said that there's entanglement and all of this stuff, but the entanglement is biggest at short distances. Okay. So the correlation function is going like 1 over x minus y squared. It's the biggest at short distances. So this is interesting. If you take a region and you just declare to divide the space up into two pieces, then there's an entanglement entropy which is ultraviolet dominated, and it's proportional to the area of what's separating the two regions. Now let's take as a special case of this. Let's take as a special case a closed area. So here's a closed area, and so system B is the outside, system A is the inside. Okay? Well, we see that there is an entanglement entropy, which again, naively can become infinitely large. But what we've seen over and over and over again in our discussions is that something definitely goes wrong when delta approaches the Planck length. So I certainly can't even talk about what physically the position of the screen is. Okay? I can't talk about what the position of the screen is even within the thickness of order delta. So at least probably there's a maximum S to which I can trust this entanglement entropy. And that maximal S is of order the area in Planck units. It's of course much smaller than that. Probably things change even before the Planck length. But certainly it doesn't make any sense to talk about areas larger than the Planck length. Okay? So we've learned something interesting, that if I want to, just in the vacuum, the amount of entanglement between the Minkowski, just between the Minkowski vacuum, between the outside and the inside, it certainly does not make sense to talk about it as being something larger than the area of this region in Planck units. Okay? Now that's just the entanglement entropy in the vacuum. You can start actually doing things. You can start trying to build other states, many other states, right? You could say, look, I'm going to make more entanglement entropy. How do you make entanglement? You're like, you put two things together, you keep one of them behind, you throw the other one into region A. So one of them stays on the outside, you throw the other one up to the inside. Okay? You just increase the entanglement entropy, right? Because now a piece of the system is entangled between you and it. Then you do it again. Then you do it again, you do it again, you do it again. So you're cranking up the entanglement entropy on top of this thing that's there in the vacuum, right? Maybe you don't trust this thing there as the vacuum. This whole thing's a little fishy. You don't like these ultraviolet cutoffs and so on. You don't believe this. But certainly, I'm going to make entanglement entropy physically by, like I said, sitting behind. I have an infinite supply of resources on the outside. I'm on the outside. I'm going to keep chucking things in. Okay? Keep chucking things in. Okay, but what happens, as I stressed in the first lecture and a number of times, and you'll hear, I'm sure, at greater length from Lenny, is that all those things that you throw in have mass or energy. And at some point, their gravitational back reaction on the region inside is no longer negligible, and they collapse it into a black hole. you can show that you can never make the entanglement entropy larger than the area in Planck units. What I showed you as a particular example here with the vacuum is true of anything. In fact, typical systems don't even come close to being able to have an entropy of order the area in Planck units. Here's a nice exercise that you should do, which you can very easily do by your dimensional analysis skills now. Okay? Imagine you have a ball of gas, which is just about to collapse into a black hole. Okay? So it's got so much mass that it's just about to collapse into a black hole. Just compute roughly what the entropy is in that ball of gas. So the temperature is T. Okay? Temperature is T. So the entropy density is T cubed. The mass is T to the fourth times R cubed. Work out GM over R is of order 1. Just do the whole calculation and find what is the total entropy in that ball of gas right at the moment where it has enough mass to collapse a black hole. You will find that the entropy goes like the area in Planck units to the power of 3/4. Okay? So at the moment where it's about to collapse into a black hole, it has way less entropy, tons less entropy, than the area in Planck units. Okay? Now, in fact, we believe that there is an absolute maximal possible entropy that you can associate to any region, any closed region of space-time like that, which is the area in Planck units, A over 4 g Newton. Okay? That's the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And you might ask, what precisely operationally does it mean? What precisely operationally does it mean to talk about the numbers of degrees of freedom or the dimensionality of the Hilbert space that might describe what's going on or whatever? Well, it really precisely operationally means this, that you can imagine doing an experiment by sending in things from minus infinity, nice well-defined experiment, make a black hole, it sits there and Hawking radiates, okay? And you just sit there as an observer at plus infinity, and you just measure every single thing that comes out. Okay? So the black hole evaporates, in the end it's gone, and now you're going to measure every single thing that comes out. Okay? You can do that. You can measure the density matrix out. Okay? Well, you can measure the trace rho log rho of that density matrix at infinity. You can measure it at any time you want. Okay? And at any time you want, when you do that measurement at infinity, trace rho log rho that you measure from your stuff at infinity puts an upper bound to the dimensionality of anything that can go on inside the system, right? So that amount of entanglement, remember, S is, so you will find that you can never make an entanglement. The entanglement entropy never increases past the area in Planck units. In fact, what really happens, the statement that information comes back out, is a statement that the entanglement entropy that you measure at infinity rises, 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 gets to about the area in Planck units at around the time when the black hole is emitted around half of its mass in Hawking radiation, and then it just starts coming back down until eventually the entanglement entropy, if you really measure every single thing that comes out, is zero. There's nothing left there anymore, so there's nothing to be entangled with. You should be left back with a pure state, and that's in fact what you get. Okay? So the entanglement entropy goes up, and then it comes back down again. There's a real observable associated with whereas if you believe information is lost, you would say the entanglement entropy goes up, the black hole is gone, but what you really measure it now is still a density matrix. And the entropy that you measure at infinity stays large. But the first thing seems to be the case. Okay? The entropy, the entanglement entropy, can never exceed the area in Planck units. So no actual experiment can force you to believe that there's more degrees of freedom inside that region. The dimensionality of the Hilbert space inside that region is larger than e to the area in Planck units. So let me just say. One other thing about this, just to substantiate something I said in the first lecture, but just so you see how hard it is to actually decide whether something is pure or mixed, and this is a kind of very intuitive fact. But let's say you have a generic state psi in a large Hilbert space. Okay. So let's say you have something that, look, you have n spins, but it looks like 1 over root 2 to the n times a bunch of spins, sigma 1, sigma 2, up to sigma n, and these things can have random, these things can be plus or minus 1. Okay. So all of them are equally likely, but I'm going to put a random phase here, e to the I theta that depends on sigma 1 up to sigma n. So the sum is overall the set of all the possible sigmas. Okay? So this is some generic state in a large complicated Hilbert space with a bunch of complicated phases here, okay? A bunch of random phases. But it's a pure state. Now, if you take this system and you project, you trace over most of the degrees of freedom, so you're looking at a k-dimensional subspace of this system. So I'm going to do a trace over n minus k of the degrees of freedom here, psi psi, to be left with some rho k. Okay. Then it's a very simple exercise to show that if these phases are random, and if k is much smaller than n, well, here I've put it so that they're all equally weighted. If you do that and k is much smaller than n, this density matrix up to exponentially small corrections is just proportional to the identity. Okay? Just goes like 1 over 2 to the k. Rho k is just 1 over 2 to the k times the identity, plus corrections that are exponentially small and go like e to the n minus k. Okay? That exponential smallness is coming from averaging 2 to the power of n minus k of these phases. You average 2 to the n minus k of these phases. The average of the phases is something, the average of the phases is something exponentially small. Average of these random phases is something exponentially small. So this just tells you something intuitive, but it makes it a little bit sharper, that if you have a big state and you're looking at a small part of it, it's going to look mixed. Of course it's going to look mixed. But the size of the corrections that tell you it's really pure, or a hint that it came from a really pure state, are exponentially small. Okay? E to the minus n minus k. It also tells you how many measurements will you have to do, how large a subpart of the system do you have to look at till you can start seeing that it's actually pure. Okay? And the answer is you have to measure almost everything. You have to start measuring order n over 2 of the states in order to even start beating the exponential. Okay? So if you have a very large system, the only even way to tell the difference, and this isn't enough to be a black hole. It can be, you know, you fire two particles together, you make a gigantic fireball, and then all the stuff comes out. Okay? People do this people do experiments like this all the time. Like this is what the nuclear physics experiments at RIC are about, right? You fire nuclei together, you make a big fireball, stuff comes out. No one doubts that that system is described by quantum mechanics. Everything is fine, it's unitary, everything is beautiful. But it's a complicated, it's a state with lots and lots of, it's a big dimensionality Hilbert space. Particles could be going this way, that way, that way. It's a large dimensionality Hilbert space. And what looks out looks thermal, right? They say, we use the word fireball. It looks thermal, even though it's a pure state. The fact that it's pure shows up in very, very subtle correlations between all these different components. But I can only see from the density matrix that it's pure by making a measurement on almost every single element of the Hilbert space. Okay? And that's the only way you start telling the difference between pure and mixed. Okay? So this is why when we now talk about the process of forming and evaporating a black hole, and we even say that there is a paradox. Is it mixed? Is it pure? In the back of our mind, in order to be able to tell the difference between whether it's mixed or pure, we have to do measurements on almost every single thing that comes out. Okay. Now, these are some things that you can work out nicely for yourselves. The typical temperature of a black hole, if its radius is r, the temperature of the Hawking radiation is just 1 over r. There's nothing else it can be, because it's coming from a quantum effect having to do with the horizon. it shouldn't be much larger than 1 over r. The wavelength shouldn't be much larger than r. That wouldn't make sense. It shouldn't be much smaller than r. That wouldn't make sense either. So all it can be, the temperature given off is just 1 over r. Okay? So just from that fact, from the mass of the black hole, from the entropy of the black hole, you can figure out that the typical number of quanta that are emitted, the typical number of quanta that are emitted by the time the black hole loses even half of its mass, is of order the entropy of the black hole. So the entropy of the black hole is a very large number, and that's also the number of quanta that are emitted. So when you say that you've done a measurement on the density matrix and you have found that the density matrix isn't pure, it's mixed, well, the only way that you could even tell the difference between that and a totally generic state, like the fireball that we talked about, is if you do of order e to the plus s black hole measurement. The information paradox involves a question about making that many measurements on the Hawking quanta coming out of a black hole. Okay? Any fewer measurements than that, and it could be a black hole, it could be a fireball, it could be a piece of wood, all these things look thermal because you have incomplete knowledge. You haven't measured every single thing which is possible. You measure every single thing that's possible, and you can have you can at least in principle distinguish between pure and mixed. But for the case of the black hole, it's this many measurements that you have to do. And so it's not ridiculous then that even though for almost every question involving the formation and evaporation of this black hole, you're going to get the right answer using semi-classical physics, that you won't get the right answer, namely that information is lost, which is the right answer you get from semi-classical physics, because that involves such an exclusive question, such a high degree of precision, that it's going to compensate for what I told you before, that there is an intrinsic e to the minus the area of the region divided by g Newton locality fuzziness. So even though it seems impossible for the information to get out of the black hole, the very question that decides that information has been lost is such a hyper-detailed question that at least it's not inconceivable, even though I haven't given you a specific mechanism, it's not inconceivable that, that it makes up for the very, very minuscule degree to which the notion of locality is totally screwed up by quantum gravity and makes an order one effect. So that's why it's actually possible for Hawking did this beautiful calculation. The answer is right. It's right for almost every question. But in order for it to correctly capture that the information is all coming back out, it would have to know about minuscule e to the minus s level correlations between all the Hawking quanta, which is not something that it can successfully do in the semi-classical approximation in which the computation was done. And to really see that all the information comes back out, you have to have in hand a consistent, complete theory. Okay, so all of these issues will be more discussed by other speakers, but let me just close by saying that so we saw what happens with horizons just in Minkowski space, with Rindler space. We see that with gravity, those horizons, which are always hot, whether or not there's gravity, when there's gravity, there's an interesting intrinsic limitation on the number of degrees of freedom that you can possibly imagine being entangled with something outside the horizon. And therefore, an intrinsic limitation on the total number of degrees of freedom you could possibly ascribe to something behind the horizon, given by the area in the Planck units. And that finally, this also applies to the cosmological horizon that we're surrounded with because the universe is accelerating. Okay? So the universe is accelerating, and in many ways that means that we're inside a horizon. Okay? So there's some particle out here which is being accelerated so quickly that, that we'll never see it again. And so, again, there's a horizon. The horizon is hot. You can lower a bucket to the horizon and cook things and wheel it back up. But in this case, very interestingly, here's an area. The area is finite. The area is just the, you know, is the area would be 1 over the Hubble squared, the Hubble being now the rate of acceleration in this case. Sorry, that's the area. So there's a finite entropy, which is, let's call it the radius of this, I'll just call it 1 over h squared in units of the Newton constant. So everything seems to make you want to assign this finite entropy to this space. That's at immediate odds, though, with your apparent bird's eye picture that, no, that's true that I can only see so much of the space. But surely it's sitting there. There's an infinite space. It's accelerating. I can only see part of it. Other observers can see other parts. But it's really this big infinite space. If you take normal semi-classical quantum field theory, definitely the size of the Hilbert space is infinite. Because all of this part here, this part there, that part there, all in this spatial slice are all independent. All commuting operators, everything is nice and independent. And yet, there should be some sense in which we're assigning a finite entropy. And the finite entropy would really mean a finite number of degrees of freedom associated with this accelerating universe. That's another major conceptual mystery. Which one of these pictures is right? It's very, very likely that the picture of the infinite universe is wrong, okay? And that this picture is right. That somehow, and somehow that would mean, very loosely, that just as in the case of black holes, what was inside the black hole eventually came back out and was encoded in very, very subtle correlations between the Hawking quanta. So in some very, very subtle sense, what's outside here is actually a scrambled version of what we have access to inside. And it just isn't true that what's outside is independent. It's actually just some linear combination of a finite number of things that we have access to inside. Now, no one has made sense of this picture, sharp mathematical sense of this picture. But it's quite likely that something like this is true. And it shows you something, I think, very exciting. This is as macroscopic as you could get, right? We're talking about not just quantum mechanics. We're talking about cosmology and beyond, what's going on beyond our horizon. And yet some deep aspect of quantum gravity has got to be kicking in and telling us that something about this naive semi-classical picture is wrong, not down to the Planck length, but at gigantic scales. Cosmologically. So anyway, also, when you're stuck inside here, I keep telling you that there are all these limitations. You can't do the experiment. You can't separate things infinitely, because if you separate them too much, they can't meet back up again and share information. So we're really stuck with this finite universe. There's another problem with this finite universe. It's constantly at some temperature. Okay, there's just even sitting in the middle of this expanding universe, there's a temperature whose typical wavelength of the thermal quanta is the size of the universe. So it's an incredibly low temperature. But if you cook anything for long enough, you will induce enormous thermal fluctuations in it. Okay, so what happens is very, very deep in the future, anything, you try to take any object at all, you try to guard it as much as you can against the forces of the outside world. You want to leave a message in a bottle for the future eternity, okay? You can't do it. At some point, the thermal fluctuations in this Sitter space will destroy your message in a bottle, okay? There is a limitation on how long you can remember anything. There's a limitation on how long anything can be recorded, stored, anything has any meaning or permanence. And now, that's an incredibly long time scale. It's associated with the fact that there is this finite temperature and a finite entropy, and it's of order e to the plus s, a gigantically long time scale. But it's still some, again, I keep telling you that in this cosmological situation, every one of the infinities that we rely on to make sharp statements in physics becomes unavailable to us. And it includes the fact that we're being continuously cooked at this very, very, very low temperature. So That's it. Those, I think, are the last set of mysteries. If I'm to summarize, I think where the subject is going in the next 10 or 20 years, I'd say first of all that it's just particularly exciting that this period is one where we're going to start getting an enormous amount of data from a whole variety of length scales. Okay? So there's the LHC, which is going to tell us what's going on at short distances. It could tell us what solves the hierarchy problem. Whatever it finds, it could discover supersymmetry, it could discover something else. And it could even tell us something about dark matter that we talked about. Some of those questions are very closely tied in to the deep things that I talked about. Some of them would just be very cool facts about the universe to know. Anyway, all of them are taking place on the 5-year time scale. 5, 10-year time scale. Then I think, really, in order of difficulty, for the other conceptual questions that we talked about, there are the remaining questions that have to do with understanding local things, understanding the clash between locality and gravity, and cosmology. And I think that these questions will likely be, addressed one at a time. That first we'll have to fully, completely understand how the clash between locality and gravity, even in flat space, is resolved. And that ultimately the next step will be to understand how it's resolved in this maximally confusing situation where we don't even have anything we know we're supposed to be computing. Okay? We don't even we lack a language for even talking about what the observables are. At least in flat space, there is a language for what the observables are. We could compute the scattering matrix, and if someone handed you one and said, here is a scattering matrix for a toy theory of gravity and other interactions and so on, you could check if they're right. You know, there's rules. Is it Lorentz invariant? Is it unitary? Does it have all the sorts of properties that it should have? So that's an achievable goal. Okay? At least you'll recognize it if you have it. I suspect that quantum gravity is telling us, the fact that there's quantum mechanics and gravity is telling us that there's a second way of talking about that S matrix. Even for ordinary physics, even for non-fancy black holes and so on related, even ordinary scattering of gauge fields and gravitons, that there's some second way of talking about that which doesn't make locality manifest. There had better be some second way of talking about it that doesn't make locality manifest if locality isn't exact. If there is some exact theory, it doesn't have locality exactly, that exact theory should reduce somehow in some approximation to the local physics that we're talking about. It's very hard to imagine that we'll do that by putting locality in the door. Okay. I think a very good analog for this is the relationship between classical and quantum. To go from classical to quantum mechanics, people have to give up determinism. Okay. But if you start thinking about classical mechanics in terms of Newton's laws, determinism is hardwired. It's manifestly deterministic. So it's very hard to jump from Newtonian mechanics to quantum mechanics, because the very concept you have to lose is hardwired. Okay. On the other hand, you could do this, and this also happened. You could cast around and find other ways of talking about classical mechanics. And there's the least action principle. The least action principle is just another way of writing classical mechanics. It's just totally equivalent, 100% equivalent, but it's not manifestly deterministic. In fact, when you first learn about it, it sounds kind of surprising that the particle really minimizes the action from A to B. How does it know where it's going? You know, the answer is that it turns out to be exactly deterministic because of the special way you treat the boundary conditions and the special kind of actions you write down and so on. Okay? But still, the formulation itself isn't manifestly deterministic. Now, you might have imagined being Lagrange or one of these people back then, and then wondering, why is it? Isn't it strange? I mean, Newton discovered classical mechanics. We have this clockwork universe. Why is it there's a second formulation? Why does even a formulation of the theory exist that isn't manifestly deterministic? That's funny. Well, we know the answer to that question now. The world isn't classical. The world is quantum mechanical. And the way the quantum mechanics smoothly matches the classical mechanics is not via Newton's laws, it's via the least action principle. Okay? Precisely because you go from A to B in every possible way, weighted by e to the I action. In that way of talking about it, the h bar goes to zero limit, it's smooth. Okay? It's just that the special properties of the action in that limit make it equivalent to something that's perfectly deterministic. Okay? So going backwards, casting around and looking for a formulation of classical mechanics that doesn't have determinism hardwired was an excellent jumping off point for then discovering quantum mechanics. So I think we're in a similar situation to cast around and look for a different way of talking about scattering processes, which so far we do with normal local quantum field theory, but a different way of doing that that doesn't involve local quantum field theory directly. Of course, it's going to be perfectly equivalent, just like the least action principle, just a rewriting of standard Newton's laws. Okay? But I suspect that if we find the second way of thinking about it, we'll be much closer to making the leap to finally remove locality altogether than we are in trying to do it from our current very, very space-time-based intuition. So I went on and on about that because it's what I'm working on now, and I motivate myself by making comments like this as often as I can. Okay. But again, I want to stress that's an intermediate scale problem. It's a problem that I suspect will be solved on the 5-year time scale, okay? Maybe 10-year time scale. But the progress is much, much more rapid than I had myself anticipated. But the thing that's looming over all of this is the final set of problems, as I've told you 15 million times now. The questions where we'd lack even a language and a pre-agreed upon set of rules for what success is, okay? If someone comes along and says, I know how to think about De Sitter space, I know how to think about cosmology, the number one thing they have to tell you is what they're computing. What it means, what they're computing, what's the output, okay? And we don't have that right now, and I think an absolutely fascinating question that I hope some of these more incremental attempts at it's a fascinating issue that again has all of the same essential issues in it, right? There's the problem of locality, gravity, and cosmology, right? So. So a hope is that understanding how to think about locality properly will give us the right tools to be able to formulate this question better. But perhaps one needs a direct frontal assault on this question as well. And a number of my colleagues are doing that, and some of them will be lecturing too, so you'll be able to hear about their approaches as well. So that's it. Thank you very much.